Organized sports can be great for kids of all ages, but medical experts are worried about children who play too much of one sport.
The whole idea of pushing through pain, that should never be a mantra for a child. If they're starting to have pain, especially around a joint, that's a sign that they're doing too much and they need to back off a little bit.
Plus, Chicago artist Jim Bakker has been taking it upon himself to fill potholes and turn them into street mosaics with images ranging from ice cream sandwiches to bags of Cheetos. And he's been doing it for years.
The last thing you'd expect in a nasty pothole is, you know, a spray of tulips or something like that. So I just think it's kind of funny. It's like an unexpected grin.
But first, the four men hoping to serve as Illinois governor met for their first debate on Thursday. We'll get analysis on that from Amanda Vinicky and Rick Pearson. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll be talking about how much sports is too much sports when it comes to our youngest athletes and a Midwest artist who fills potholes with his art. But first, on Thursday night, the four men who want to serve as our next governor met for their first debate.
Mr. Pritzker is dodging your question because he doesn't want to tell the truth to the people of Illinois.
Governor Rauner has a casual relationship with the truth. He lied to the Cardinal
of
Chicago.
You have a casual one with Rod Blagojevich.
He lied about wanting a $1 billion tax cut for people when actually proposed a budget that would raise taxes.
Neither one of
the record air my support.
Neither one of you guys. You wouldn't even come over to the Tribune to debate.
You're a liar. You've been lying
purpose.
To the people of Illinois from the very beginning.
Mr.
You said you had no social agenda, and all you've been able to accomplish
Mr.
is to make
McCann,
yourself the most progressive liberal governor the state of Illinois has ever had.
Mr.
You're
McCann.
A liar and a thief.
Mr.
Senator,
McCann,
you'll have
are
a
you
chance.
Getting paid on a per interruption basis by Madigan or on a lump sum?
That was Governor Bruce Rauner, J.B. Pritzker, Cash Jackson, and State Senator Sam McCann. Thanks to NBC Chicago for that audio. They sponsored that debate, which, as you heard, was contentious with lots of personal attacks between the four candidates. Election Day is 43 days away, and we wanted to unpack what we heard on Thursday night and get an update on this governor's race. Joining us to do that now, two veteran political reporters. Rick Pearson is with the Chicago Tribune. Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent with WTTW Chicago Tonight. Both of them are on the line. Amanda, Rick, welcome back to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
Rick, how combative would you rate this in terms of the accusations and personal attacks? Certainly, we've seen this so far with ads. If anyone, you can't open YouTube or turn on your TV without hearing some of this. But this was in person.
Yeah, and that's kind of what makes it different, because in past settings among gubernatorial candidates or candidates for any other office, confronted with some of the language that they've been using in their negative attack advertising, they tend to be more reticent. But this was purely all about attacks. This was a debate that merely became an echo chamber for the millions of dollars of advertising that both Governor Rauner and J.B. Pritzker have put on the air. And you know, you wonder, does that have any value? Because, like you said, we've just been flooded with these ads for more than 16 months, really. And have people tuned out of them? Or is it now, because we're, you know, only 40-some days before the election, is there that other part of the electorate now that's finally tuning in? And so I don't know that there's really much practical value in all of this, except it further defined just how low this campaign is getting in terms of how people are just trying to sully their opponents rather than putting forth their own ideas.
We will try to talk about some of the very few ideas that did to get discussed. But Amanda, I wonder how much of this, what do you think is dry? Do you think there are deep policy differences? Do you think there is personal dislike? Do you think this is a reflection of the national partisan atmosphere? What do you think is driving such a bitter campaign here?
It's a bit of all of the above, and most certainly there are
definite policy differences. I mean, you can go back and there are times where you talk to people and voters will say, well, what's the point? Every candidate is the same. That is certainly not the case with these two men. They are most certainly presenting different visions of government, or at least how they believe government should be run, what it needs, especially when you get to tax policy, as I presume we will soon get to. That said, there most certainly, I think, is frankly disgust, maybe lack of respect even for one another. I mean, it's interesting, actually, J.B. Pritzker and Bruce Rauner, so the two leading candidates in this race, of course, have known one another for a while. They are both very wealthy men who run, therefore, in similar philanthropic circles, have served on boards together, all of that. And yet, I think what came across for me most of all in that debate was, while you did hear, of course, some of the, you know, canned, sort of rote, practiced responses, more than anything, it was real open dislike, particularly when you heard from Governor Rauner that, you know, you're not fit to be a politician. As somebody who has covered him closely now for these, 4 years, it is clear he believes that he is different because he, quote, made his money while Pritzker inherited it. I think Pritzker truly believes, as do many others in Illinois that were disgusted by the impasse, an impasse that we've spent many hours on the radio talking about, and I don't think you can clearly say who is 100% at fault for it, but that share the blame. And yet Democrats, Pritzker in particular, see that as the fault of one man and the responsibility of the man at top, and that's Governor Rauner. And that was really what came across during this debate.
And Rick, it's interesting that about Amanda's observations, because 4 years ago, Governor Rauner was the person who had no political experience, who was the business person who was running for office. And essentially, do you feel like that's a lot of what he's attacking J.B. Pritzker for now?
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of like everything old is new again. And when you look at 4 years ago and you had Bruce Rauner as kind of this blank slate candidate that people could kind of project the kind of change they wanted to see against the record of Democratic Governor Pat Quinn. Pat Quinn had a record, had a long record in government. There was a lot for Rauner to go after. Now, 4 years later, here you have J.B. Pritzker, the wealthy businessman, playing the outside. Bruce Rauner is trying to still convey to people that he's an outsider and not really a politician, but now he does have a record. And now he does have to answer for his tenure in office. It's why people ask, what have you accomplished in 4 years? Why do you deserve another term in office? But unlike 4 years ago, where it was just the two leading candidates, you throw in Sam McCann, the Republican state senator from Plainview, who's running under the Conservative Party banner. And now you've kind of got Rauner being attacked on both sides by someone who represents the social conservative base of the Republican Party, particularly downstate. And then you've got Pritzker representing the Democratic side on attacks. And so it's kind of a two-front challenge that Rauner is facing.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune, Amanda Vinicky with WTTW's Chicago Tonight, about last week's debate, the first of three meetings between at least this was with all four candidates. We know that Bruce Rauner and J.B. Pritzker, the two front runners, will meet at least two other times. I will point out, as lots of people have pointed out, only one of those is outside of Chicago. It is in Quincy, Illinois. They are not meeting in any of the bigger cities outside of Chicago. None of the cities in other people who are in the listening areas of the 21st. So I should point that out to all of you who are listening. Let's play a little bit of audio of some of the Carol Marine tried to get to some of the substance of the issues. And this is related to taxes and the state's finance. NBC's Carol Marine asked the four candidates for a show of hands, yes or no, on whether they'd consider several different ways to raise revenue.
Raise your hand if you would consider raising the sales tax on any services. I take that as a no from all of you. Would you consider extending taxes to retirement income? A show of hands. Again, I take that as a no. Not even attorney's fees. I believe Governor Rauner on sales taxes, you once suggested that. Mr. Pritzker, I thought you opened the door to some possibility of some services. No?
No.
Okay.
Again, thanks to NBC Chicago for that. Rick, were you surprised that no one raised their hands, or was it because no one wants to campaign on raising taxes, even when we know the state is in some, has some very serious fiscal challenges?
I found that whole segment entirely unbelievable. There's no doubt that as the state faces these fiscal challenges, issues such as extending the state sales tax to services is one of those things that's going to have to be explored, because this is a reflection of the economy that we're living in, and that has to be addressed. And so, in fact, Bruce Rauner did talk about, as a candidate for governor, about the potential of extending taxes to certain services. So for them to just blanketly say no, that's highly unbelievable. The whole issue, though, of looking at retirement benefits, which the state does not tax, that's like a third rail. I mean, that's like discussions about Social Security on the federal level. And so the idea that looking at retirement benefits, taxing retirement benefits as a potential source of revenue, I think is pretty unlikely.
Amanda, and just a reminder to our audience, Illinois doesn't tax, as Rick is pointing out, retirement income, but then also services, which is, this has been a big discussion in Illinois. This is not in keeping with most states and their taxation. And this is something that has been a conversation, lots of policy recommendations from different groups that Illinois should start taxing services. Right, Amanda?
That has long been seen as an opportunity for Illinois to keep up with the modern economy, where you have services outpacing actual items these days.
So like manicures, hair salons, things like that.
Manicures, attorney's fees. I think when actually the governor, when he was running 4 years ago, had proposed some fairly tight confines on that. So things that maybe you wouldn't notice, or that, again, you talk about what Pritzker is running on now, and this is, quote, you know, tax the rich more than the middle class, although we don't have any actual rates from Pritzker to prove where he would go or what he would do with that. But it was things like joining a country club, or, you know, any fees associated with having a yacht, things like that. There are a whole lot of services that right now are escaped in Illinois. And so that is talked about. I think it was truly remarkable to watch that display of all four candidates refusing to not only raise their hands, but to speak up. I mean, you heard there, Pritzker, I thought that you had opened the door, because he's made a couple of statements during some debates.
And everyone, it was kind of like all of their hands up, like, no, not me. I don't want to raise taxes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. They like wanted to duck and hide, and not only not raise their hand, it was get me off this stage. I don't want to be seen on a stage where that three letter word is even uttered. And that truly speaks to how Illinois got into the state where there are as enormous fiscal challenges as Illinois is facing, and it does not bode well for actually solving those issues in the future when you have candidates who, surely that is backed by polling. I think that is part of where it's this vicious cycle where voters are disgusted by candidates that are afraid of confronting real issues and telling the truth, and so then politicians don't tell the truth, and they run as if everything is, you know, hunky-dory, or just pointing the fingers at the other guy.
Right, which is a tough argument to make right now in Illinois, correct, Amanda?
Yeah,
just to stay on that, right, to stay on that three-letter word of taxes, because this is something, this is a really important issue for voters. Rick, I wonder, Amanda touched on this briefly, just the whole idea of income taxes. Did we learn anything more about the candidate's position on income taxes and what that looks like when we've heard a lot of conversation about a flat tax versus a progressive tax? Rick?
Well, no, and we're not going to hear anything definitive from J.B. Pritzker before the election about what he thinks the tax rate should be, about what he considers to be middle class. Here, that's part of that blank slate that I talked about, is he's talking about a plan that would tax the wealthy while reducing the tax burden on middle income and lower income families. But we're not going to hear what those rates are going to be. And that's that vacuum is what's created that opening for Bruce Rauner to go after that. But at the same time, you have Bruce Rauner, who said he wants to cut the Illinois income tax, but hasn't explained how he would do that, what services he would cut. We all know what our debt is in this state, including pensions. And, you know, going back to that question about taxing services, I wonder if somebody had said, well, what if you tax services and it meant reducing the property tax? I wonder how many hands might have gone up there. You know, the property taxes, everybody hates taxes, but obviously, you know, the issue of property taxes has been so important in this election year, particularly in Chicago, with questions about how property is assessed, leading to the ouster of the Cook County assessor in the Democratic primary. You know, tax modernization. The Illinois tax system needs modernization.
Right. All of those are very substantial issues that are probably not super sexy when it comes to a debate, the first debate meeting between candidates, right? We just have a minute left, so I want to ask both of you very quickly, what was one moment that stood out to you that we haven't talked about? Amanda?
You know, moments that stuck out to me, particularly, I think, for your listeners, many are confronted by the question of what is going to happen with their pensions. That is yet another area that has not seen a lot of discussion. We do, frankly, know where Governor Bruce Rauner stands on that, but we still don't have a straight answer from J.B. Pritzker on what he would actually do. And given the significant weight of pensions and the debt that faces Illinois' finances, that is something else that is, frankly, voters should be really upset about.
Rick, can you give me a couple words here? Just a few words?
Sure. Just one thing, and I would say the importance of who's governor in drawing the map lines for the next legislature. And I'm always surprised that that isn't like a Republican defense mechanism that Governor Rauner uses.
That's Rick Pearson with the Chicago Tribune. Amanda Vinicky, I want to thank as well, with WTTW's Chicago Tonight. As we said, the first of three debates that will happen before the election, which is 43 days away. Rick, Amanda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting video, sound, and sculpture by Irish artists Gareth Kennedy and Sarah Brown in the exhibition Kennedy Brown, The Special Relationship, opening October 4th at 5:30 p.m. More at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's been a month since the school year started back up again, and many of you listening out there may have had children involved with sports who have been practicing all summer long. Or maybe this isn't the time of the year when they pick up a new sport, whether it's swimming, tennis, basketball. This is a good thing, something we encourage when it comes to making friends and spending time outdoors. But is there such a thing as too much sports? Some medical experts are worried that overdoing it could lead to long-term injuries. We spoke about this topic earlier this year, and I spoke with Dr. Cynthia Labella, a pediatric orthopedist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital. Brendan McHale was in studio with us in Urbana. He's a supervisor of sports medicine and athletic training services at Carle Foundation Hospital. And Kurt Gibson also joined us. He's the associate executive director of the Illinois High School Association. I started by asking Dr. Labella whether she was seeing more kids specializing in just one sport.
It's definitely more common these days than when I grew up decades ago. The culture has changed quite a bit. There are so many more opportunities, I think, for kids to play a sport year-round. You know, years ago, you played the sport during its season. And, for instance, there wasn't an opportunity to play basketball outside of the basketball season, or baseball outside of the baseball season, or soccer. But now you can pick any of those sports, and there are indoor facilities and leagues and that you can play in year-round. So the opportunities have greatly expanded.
And as the opportunities have expanded, I imagine you've seen injuries expand as well, Dr. Labella?
Well, that's a great question. I think that there's a lot of research now focused on that to see if, with expansion of all these opportunities and parents and kids taking advantage of them, are we seeing an increase in injuries? And so there are a few studies that suggest that, especially with sports that require repetition of one specific movement over and over again to perfect a skill. So an example would be something like tennis or baseball, where you're throwing the ball or swinging the racket again and again, that can put some wear and tear on the body if you're doing that year-round. So there is some concern that overuse injuries are becoming more prevalent because there is not as much downtime for the body to repair tissues and recover and heal.
And we're going to talk about particular what that means for younger bodies in a moment. But Brenton, I wanted to ask you what you're seeing at Carle Foundation when it comes to our younger athletes.
We're seeing some of what Dr. LaBelle had mentioned, but there's also that transition period when they're going from one sport to the next. In that transition time, they're not used to the demands of the new sport that they are transitioning into. So sometimes if we have some athletes that want to take it a little too fast and try to accelerate their, whether it be their learning curve of that particular sport or just practice a little bit more, and the body's not used to that, the demands of that particular sport, that we'll see some injuries there. And sometimes, I mean, it can be a chronic thing, or something can turn into a chronic thing. But most of these acute injuries will hopefully, if the young athlete is smart about it, will be able to bounce back from that injury and it won't be with them forever.
Kurt, I wanted to bring you into this conversation with IHSA. That's the or a body that regulates competition in most high school sports and a few other activities. Our coaches, do you think, it makes sense that I think coaches oftentimes might encourage students to focus on one sport. Do you think that youth sports are getting more competitive than they used to be in the past?
Well, I think without a doubt they're getting much more competitive. I'm finishing my 16th year here at our office, and I would say over that time, the growth of non-school programs has been the biggest challenge that we face internally here at our office, that our member schools face. And I do think there was a time when coaches were trying to influence their, their better athletes to focus on one sport throughout an entire school year. But I think we're starting to see that trend starting to change, and change in a good way. We're hearing more and more about schools working with their student bodies and their coaching staffs to encourage multi-sport participation and trying to get students to move away from this idea of putting all my eggs in one athletic basket.
But, Kurt, you mentioned also programs outside of high school. I wonder how much, especially, we're seeing kids who, I'm thinking of the young people in my family who are focusing on basketball and then are playing basketball, not just in school, but in other leagues. Are we seeing that a lot? Kids playing in leagues that are outside of school as well, hoping to improve their game, get college scholarships, those sorts of things?
That does seem to be still happening, yes.
Dr. LaBelle, I wonder what role you see parents playing in all of this. Do we think that parents are pushing kids, or certainly there are kids who are also, this is something they really want to do as well?
Well, I've seen it both situations, actually. Every family's a little different, but I've seen situations where it's the kid pushing the parents to sign them up for all these things, and I've seen other situations where the parent is really pushing the kid to sign up for things year-round. So I think it's nice. We have the opportunity in our clinic to get to know patients and families, unfortunately, when they have an injury, but then there's always a discussion about prevention after they get better and sending them back to sports. And then we get to know the family and the kid, and we can kind of counsel appropriately depending on who's the one kind of driving this year-round training and focus and emphasize the need for breaks periodically to let the body kind of rest and recover and heal.
And Brenton, I wanted to ask you about that. When we're talking about breaks and the need for the body to rest and heal, when we're thinking particularly about young people, how important is that?
Important, and I think the best way to approach it is have more of a team approach where we can always ask the children to listen to their bodies, but sometimes they're not going to be able to do that because they don't know quite what to listen for. whether it be, you know, not necessarily swelling, but something that turns from an ache into an injury. And that's why it's really important that the parents have a good communication with them about practice, and then getting the coach involved. So if we have all of those individuals working at making sure that these kids are improving and not overdoing it, and sometimes they just need just a day off or a little bit of a break from a sport and kind of get their get rested up and be able to respond the way that everyone wants them to.
We're talking about youth sports and about injuries that can happen if you don't take a break when you are young. Dr. Cynthia LaBella is on the line from Chicago, where she's a pediatric orthopedist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and Lurie Children's Hospital. In studio with me here in Urbana is Brendan Hale, who's a supervisor of sports medicine and athletic training services at Carl Foundation Hospital. And on the line from Bloomington, Kurt Gibson is with us with the Illinois High School Association. Dr. LaBella, can you help us understand a little bit more of what happens when breaks don't happen, as Brendan is saying, and particularly when we're thinking about, you alluded to this earlier, it's young people, their bodies are still growing. What kind of impact injuries can have on a growing body?
Sure. We watch young people running around out there, and we think they're endless energy, and they can keep going forever. So it's easy to forget that they need breaks, too. And the suggestion of at least one day off per week is definitely something that we recommend. And it doesn't mean you have to sit on the couch for that day. It just means
not playing that
activity.
Sport. Right.
Exactly. Not doing some intense, strenuous training or a supervised practice or competition. So, you know, you can go out and walk or ride your bike or go for a swim. Something recreational would be a very healthy thing to do to let your body sort of rest and recover. And it's during those rest and recovery times that your body's tissues repair themselves. You know, every time you go out and do a two-hour strenuous practice, whether it's a soccer practice or baseball or gymnastics, there's a little bit of tissue breakdown in your muscles, your bones, and your body uses that 24 hours in between from one workout to the next to repair all those tissues and make them stronger. And that's how you build bone density from being active, and you build muscle strength from being involved in sports and physical activity. If you don't give your body that break to rebuild that tissue, eventually it does start to break down, and the wear and tear can produce what we call an overuse injury to any of those structures. You can get a stress fracture in a bone from too much stress on the bone. You can get a tendonitis from too much stress on a tendon or a strain in the muscle. So all of those things can happen in kids. One thing that makes kids unique is, you mentioned, they're still growing. So number one, they need some of that energy that they're expending on sports. Some of that energy has to go to growth of the tissues, right? Because their bones are getting longer and their muscles are getting bigger just because they're growing. So they need that to conserve energy for growth. But also they have growth centers in their bones that are uniquely vulnerable to overuse injuries. Those little growth plates can definitely break down sooner and start to become painful sooner in a kid. So it's something for parents to be aware of, and certainly this whole idea of pushing through pain, that should never be a mantra for a child. If they're starting to have pain, especially around a joint, that's a sign that they're doing too much and they need to back off a little bit.
Brendan, what kind of things do you tell parents, and as well as parents or caregivers or other adults in kids' lives? It is hard balance, right? Because I think you obviously, no one wants their child to be in pain, but at the same time, you have to try to figure out how to manage the pain versus continuing to play.
Right. Well, the biggest thing, if they are sore, there's a reason why, and that's the body trying to tell us they need to take a little break. And some of those injuries can happen not just from physically being fatigued, but also mentally, because if they're exhausted or tired from lack of sleep, or just lack of, you know, just constantly going. If they're not eating a well-balanced diet, that doesn't give them the fuel that they need to do or to be successful in whatever it is they're practicing or playing. So there's a lot of things that contribute to the injury, and it's not, you know, everyone likes to easily focus on the the fatigue factor physically, but there's also some mental issues in there, and that's why sleep habits are incredibly important, as well as nutritional habits.
Kurt, when we think about coaches in IHSA, what kind of messages is IHSA giving coaches to be on the lookout for this and helping? Because coaches play a huge role in student athletes' lives as well.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Our Sports Medicine Advisory Committee has had some initial discussions on how to best communicate to schools the importance of emphasizing this need for students to give themselves physical rest, as well as the mental rest we're talking about. I think there's even another side to that that's not being discussed. You know, students who are through this extended participation in one sport, trying to pursue perhaps college scholarship, they're putting themselves under tremendous mental strain. And we're starting to see and hear from our schools now the first signs of some maybe mental health issues that need to be addressed. You know, when students begin to feel excessive pressure, they might turn to other activities like drugs or drinking that might, you know, be a release for them because they're on the go so much. And I'm certainly not trying to insinuate in all cases, but it's a sometimes overlooked part of the rest piece that we've been discussing. But from our sports medicine standpoint, we've been having some initial discussions on how we can best communicate to schools and help put resources in their hands to remind their students of the importance of not only getting rest, but trying to develop their whole bodies and being multi-sport athletes. We're hearing more and more stories of schools offering incentives, special letters to seniors who play three sports over each of their 4 years in high school. So I think there's really beginning to become a new trend to emphasize multi-sport participation and involvement in more than just one program than we've seen in probably the last 10 to 15 years.
Kurt, what advice do you have for parents on this front, particularly when you're talking about the mental health aspects of this?
I think you have to let your sons and daughters find their way. And I say that as a father of four sons who, you know, grew up playing sports. You want to see your children do well. I get that. You want them to be successful. But whether they pursue an athletic, you know, pursuit or not, it's not a reflection on you as a parent. You know, I think our concern as parents should be more, what kind of person are we, you know, helping to mold our young children into, and worry less about whether they get that scholarship. Worry more about them being a good, well-rounded person. And that would be sort of a message I would offer to parents. Let the student sort of dictate where they want to go, how serious they want their involvement to be.
Dr. Labella, what about you? What advice do you have for parents who are listening in on this conversation?
Oh, sure. I echo everything that Kurt just said. I think that sports are a tremendous benefit for kids for multiple reasons, both physically, mentally, socially. But we need to balance that with other things that they pursue. And so I think that we advise parents to make sure there's a balance in their child's life and that they have time for social activities with friends and academic pursuits as well as their sports. So that's a big focus. And as Kurt mentioned, following the child. You know, sometimes a parent may have a dream for the child, but that's not exactly matching with what the child is choosing. And I'm a parent, too, and that can be hard, but that's the challenge. And I think that if we start doing that with our kids, we'll follow them to success because they're the ones driving it then.
And, Brendan, to your point also, making sure that kids also learn to recognize the signs of their own bodies as well. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Brendan McHale with Carle Foundation Hospital, Northwestern University's Dr. Cynthia LaBelle, and IHSA's Kurt Gibson for being with me to talk about this. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're driving on the road, you've probably hit a pothole at one time or another. It's especially bad here in the Midwest. And one artist has been taking matters into his own hands for years by not just filling the potholes himself, but adding his own mosaic street art for all to see. Jim Bakker is a graphic and mosaic artist in Chicago. His designs are whimsical, sometimes political, and always colorful and intricate. Recently, Jim installed 10 pothole mosaics in his hometown of Detroit, including one of a raw chicken and one of Aretha Franklin. Back in June, he joined us from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston, and I started by asking him to tell me the story of how this all got started one night 5 years ago.
It's a long story. I'll try to keep it short. But I got into mosaics initially because they're so incredibly durable, specifically the ancient technique. And back in 2013, the pothole season, at least in our street on the northwest side of Chicago, was particularly bad. And there was one stubborn pothole in front of our house that kind of refused to stay fixed. And so I kind of had the idea of merging this passion of this art form that I love so much that was so durable and making a piece of art and fixing that pothole myself.
And is it right that you were first inspired to do mosaic art, which is what you use in these potholes, when you were traveling in Pompeii?
Right. That's, you know, it was, it all started just kind of unexpectedly with a tour guide saying, pointing out a mosaic and saying, you know, this art looks essentially the way the artist intended, because marble and glass don't fade and they're set into mortar. And my background is a designer in the ad biz, so I was already you know, this, a creative person, and that just kind of lit my imagination on fire that I could do artwork that could last incredibly long.
Last longer than the pothole, especially when it's a pothole, right? Because I think everyone thinks that potholes, especially in Chicago, it's notorious for potholes that are repaired every year that seem to never, that same exactly. pothole pops back up again. Can you share with us what this actually involves, both filling the actual pothole and then this mosaic work that you do? How do you do that?
Sure. What happens is all the artwork's done in my studio ahead of time. So I have a 1970 pickup truck that I carry all my supplies with. And so once I find an ideal candidate pothole, I show up there with my truck. I've got the piece of art ready to go. I mix the concrete on site. I've got water and, you know, buckets and mixing stuff and whatnot. Fill the pothole, slide the artwork on top of the wet cement. I won't get into the details too far, but it takes a couple hours to install it. And then once it's good to go, at that point, I kind of protect it with serious traffic cones and maybe a tarp. And then I need to come back, depending on the temperatures, 8 to 10 hours later, once the concrete's hardened, with wire brushes and whatnot, and I scrub it really good and make it look as pretty as possible. Take a bunch of photographs of it because it's as good as it's ever going to look, and then move on.
And is there an ideal size of a pothole? I remember in Chicago once we had folks to send us pictures, and they had people put their children in potholes. It was so big. It was sort of their size. Right. How big of a pothole is ideal for you to do your work in?
It's 18 by 24 inches. I actually have a pothole spec sheet I give people, because the most difficult part of the process is finding good ones. I mean, they're all over the place, but if I'm going to spend the time and money to install something, I want it to be in a pothole that isn't a trash street that's going to get repaved soon or is unstable and whatnot. But 18 by 24 inches, not in the center of the road, because I can't block traffic when I'm doing this stuff. It can't be too deep, can't be too shallow. Like I mentioned, the asphalt on the street needs to be pretty stable to house the art, that it's going to stick and stay there for a period of time.
So I feel like you've probably learned a lot about our road infrastructure as you've done this.
Reluctant expert, I guess. The first half a dozen or so I did, kind of most of them failed because of lessons learned about protecting them and making sure that that cars aren't going to run over the concrete while it's still wet, or it's too cold and the concrete takes too long to set, and, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff.
And how do you decide what kind of image to go with? You have everything from a bag of Cheetos to flowers to an ice cream sandwiches to words saying this is not a pothole. My favorite might be the mosaic you did of a Chicago parking ticket. But how do you decide what to do?
Basically, you know, I've got a series of, well, a series of series going on. A common theme is called universal truths, meaning I juxtapose a universal hate, potholes. I mean, nobody likes potholes. with something that is kind of like a universal love, like ice cream or flowers. So it's just kind of juxtaposing those two concepts that perhaps somebody is driving or walking down the street and they happen to glance at the street, not expecting anything. And about the last thing you'd expect in a nasty pothole is, you know, a spray of tulips or something like that. So I just think it's kind of funny. It's like an unexpected grin.
It's an unexpected grin. You've developed quite a following both online and in life. I've listened. You've had very successful Kickstarter campaigns. Yep. Were you surprised that this kind of public art struck such a chord with so many people?
Totally. You know, in retrospect, you know, this is not what I thought initially, is like it's a universal thing that people can relate to. I mean, I've gotten emails and calls from all over the world because everyone can relate to it, whether you're rich, poor, short, tall, young, old, it doesn't matter. Everyone can relate to it, and pretty much everyone hates them. So, you know, I started the campaign initially. My thing is still fine art mosaics, which you don't really see, things that actually hang up on a wall. I just thought when I started this initially was that this would be a nice little PR campaign to maybe draw attention to my fine artwork. And what has happened over the past 5 years is it's completely taken over. I don't have much time to do original art anymore. I can sell it, but I don't even have time to make it. So it's kind of funny.
Well, and also I think that's something kind of funny also about public art, right? And I wonder what your thoughts are on it now. That kind of fine mosaic work that you're talking about is something that can be quite expensive, especially for someone to acquire. This is something that you've made available for everyone to enjoy. What has this experience taught you about the nature of public art?
That's a good question. It's an amazing, I guess it's just an amazing way to get a message out that just sticks. You know, it's not going anywhere, especially the stuff that I do. You know, it's not going to get painted over or anything like that. So it's just the power of this kind of semi-permanent billboard about whatever you want to say, whether it's something about you or something about politics or something that's just kind of funny that you want to get your dry wit out there for people to kind of, you know, maybe appreciate or something. It's an amazingly powerful form of getting, you know, the message out that stays out there while you continue on with your life doing other things.
And I wanted to ask you about, speaking of political, a pothole that you did last year, kind of near the Trump Tower. It's a mosaic that says the word liar superimposed on a Russian flag. Mm-hmm. Is that one still around?
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's in great shape. I love the whole idea behind that piece, and I love the story afterward, because that kind of really came out of left field for what I do. You know, almost all my work is very upbeat or light or funny or whatever, and this kind of came out of nowhere and surprised everybody, annoyed some people, lost some followers, gained some followers, you know. So it was just it was a very interesting experience, because 99.9% of the time reaction to my work's been positive. And that's the one piece where there was a percentage, a very small percentage, but there was a few people that weren't happy with me. The other bonus I just like to throw in with that particular piece is there's actual gold in the piece. There's the perimeter is done with a very expensive type of gold that has actual gold leaf adhered to the top. So
wow.
I like the idea of something of a little bit of value being, you know, stuck in the street like that.
All of this is not necessarily legal.
I don't know.
How does it work? Do you ever have encounters? As I'm thinking about as you're doing this, I wonder how does that work when you're showing up and you've got hours of installing and having concrete? And I like the idea that you're setting out parking cones. Do people think you're working with the city when you're doing this stuff?
Totally. Yeah. You know, and it's like an unintentional consequence. I really do it because I don't want to get hurt, you know, but it just so happens I also look like a city worker. I mean, I learned my lesson about getting small cones. Now I have serious cones. I used to use my boys' soccer cones, and those don't work because they're too small and lightweight and they blow away. So, you know, I learned my lesson there. But, you know, an orange vest and orange cones. So people just think I'm a city worker that's working too hard on one particular piece of, you know, pothole.
And so I should say, for the most part, when city officials are asked about this, they say something along the lines of, oh, we love the spirit of this, but please leave pothole filling to the authorities. What do you think about that?
And, you know, that's, you know, sure. I don't mind. It's funny. That's the only communication I've had indirectly with the city about this. And I've had about a half dozen or so interactions with the police. And those have all more or less have been positive once they know what I'm doing. And now a lot of people, especially in Chicago, know what I'm doing. So they might recognize me as I'm installing stuff. It's like, hey, I know what you're doing. But I even had one interaction with the police on the south, actually in the University of Chicago area. And I was working and I sensed a car pulling up to me, and it's happened before. And sometimes it's just a passenger car and sometimes it's not. In this case, I looked and I could see that there's a blue stripe of the Chicago police car. And I'm like, you just don't know. Like I said, I've had about a half dozen interactions and you just don't know. Is this the one where things are going to go sideways? And the guy comes out and he just kind of looks at me and he points at me and he's like, I hear that pothole guy. And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, that's so effing cool. So, you know, it's kind of fun how it's, you know, it's unofficially sanctioned, I guess.
Right. And so you're working on a coffee table book with this art. I saw there's a bike tour that you're leading through Chicago. What are you hoping people learn about the city through all of your work?
It's such a Chicago thing. I don't know, celebrating. It's gritty. It's Midwestern. It's kind of funny. You get a little exercise at the same time with the bike tour and whatnot. But it's just, I don't know, a little levity that we're all, you know, it just kind of brings everybody together. I bet so many people around the city from all different neighborhoods, because like to my previous point, everyone can relate to it. So it's a fun way to get people together. And then with the pothole book, that all stems from the Kickstarter campaigns. And you know, when people donate, you want to give them rewards for helping you out. And so depending on the tier, you know, got T-shirts and stickers and whatnot. But some of the higher tiers, I'm offering up the pothole art book. Actually, this is the second edition. The first edition sold out last year. So this edition, it's an edition of 300 signed and numbered books. That was offered to this year's Kickstarter folks. And it's also available on my website, which I think I've got about half gone.
All right. Well, we will tweet out links so you can see Jim's work and find out more information about him. Jim Bakker is a graphic and mosaic artist talking to us about his public art in Chicago and how this movement has also spread throughout the country and the world. Jim, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Coming up this week on the 21st, we're live from all across Champaign-Urbana. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., we'll be at Research Park talking about some of the cool things coming out of the University of Illinois. We'll also be at the Champaign Farmers Market at 5 o'clock tomorrow evening. If you want to come out and say hello, we'd love to see you. And on Thursday at 11 a.m., we will be at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts giving you a preview of the Pygmalion Festival. So please, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, come out. We'd love to see you. That's all the time we have for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle's 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page to like us. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, just go to our website, 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.